Well, good morning, everyone. Hope you don't mind it. I stole a little time on this class yesterday in the exhortation. That was to give you some of the background leading up to what we're actually going to look at in Zechariah's night visions. That was the goal, and hopefully that will work. We looked last night at how, in Jeremiah's time, how things had gotten so bad in the community that God had to actually take his people up to Babylon, take the good figs up there, regrow the community, and then bring them back. Now, he promised that he would bring them back, and at that time, he said when he brought them back that he would rebuild, and so he did. He saved the temple vessels, he saved the things that he wanted, and he promised he would bring them back. And so when you reach the period of Zechariah, Zechariah is a prophet, and he's prophesying right at that time period when they were attempting to rebuild the temple. And if you're not real familiar with the historical period, hopefully we can pick that up as we go along this week, and you'll see how all this fits together. What's really fun to do is to have a look at how Zechariah and Haggai and Malachi and Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther all fit together, really, in terms of like one package deal. We just did that with some of the kids at the California Youth Conference maybe about a month ago or so. And that's fun to look at how all of those books fit together and the interconnection of those books. So have you ever studied Zechariah's night visions? Do you have any idea what they're even about? Let's see. This is an interesting one. Isn't it interesting? We do the Bible readings, you know, year after year, and we go through these things. We've read them through probably a number of times, but it's still difficult to put in your mind what this is really all about, why it happened, what it was all about. And even when you do, you know that the two prophets were working together, Zechariah and Haggai. And I think a lot of us probably have never even thought about why two prophets. What did the two prophets actually do? And hopefully as we go along this week, we can answer some of those questions and have a look at what was going on. The prophet Zechariah, I guess first of all, we got to find out where that is, right? In our Bibles, it's way at the end of the Old Testament, right? So Zechariah is going to be about this time period when they come back from the captivity. So you're going to be in this period where Zechariah and Malachi and Haggai are sort of like all together. Zechariah and Haggai were right exactly in the same time period. So his name means Yah is remember, right? For those of you that like the meanings of names, and he's the son of Berechiah, who's the blessing of Yah, and he's the grandson of Iddo. You know, and this is probably the same Iddo who returned with Zerubbabel back, and he's actually mentioned in Nehemiah chapter 12. So Iddo would have been a fairly old person at this point, and we're moving now, and this is his grandson who's alive, and Zechariah is going to come in and give prophecies. This leads people to believe that probably Zechariah was a younger man. He's the grandson of Iddo who had returned, so he's probably a younger man, whereas we're going to see that Haggai was probably one of the older ones. If you've ever read up on Zechariah or had any classes on Zechariah in our Christadelphian community, it's always interesting to watch what happens with our writers. Many of our Christadelphian writers have had trouble with Zechariah because if you go back and you look at, well, what did John Thomas say about Zechariah? And you look, what did John Thomas say about Zechariah? Well, most of what John Thomas wrote was in articles that he wrote on Bible prophecy related to Revelation. So what he did is he took Zechariah's prophecies, took some of these visions, and showed you how they applied in the end times. He didn't really comment on some of the other visions because they weren't as obvious about end time things or he wasn't interested in using them. And what that has done is it's caused some of our writers to look back at Zechariah, or you listen to classes online if you download tapes and listen to them, and they'll go through Zechariah's seven night visions that you just saw up there a minute ago, and you look at the seven night visions, and what they'll do is they'll take vision one up there and they'll say, well, vision one's in the future. And then vision two, well, that's about the horns and about the carpenters, well, that must have been about the past. And then vision 3, that's about the walls of Jerusalem, so maybe that one's past. And then vision 4, that's about Joshua becoming high priest. That was about Jesus Christ when he came. And what they do is they flip-flop back and forth between past, future, past, future, past, future. And it's caused a lot of trouble as we've been trying to go through the whole story of Zechariah. So what I want to do is at least mention to you from the start that I really believe that what you can do with Zechariah is that all of the night visions had an historical application. And that's where we want to start this week. All seven night visions had an historical application to the time of rebuilding the temple. And I think you could probably take all seven night visions and give them a future application as well, future from the time of Zechariah. So that's what we'll do, is we'll hopefully look at, I'm going to spend most of my time looking at the historical application, because first of all, that was the one, I always think when you study Bible prophecy, it's always good to understand the historical, so that you can then look at what it might mean in the future based on the historical. You don't just start with the future and guess and say, well, what do you think it means? You first of all research the historical, find out what did it mean, and then you have a basis to understand the future application. I think that's much sounder than just guessing at what we think a future application might be. So our understanding in this case is going to help in terms of understanding the future application. Now, when you go back over the history of this time period, if you just, quickly go through what was going on when they came back from the captivity. Now remember, Ezra, the beginning of the book of Ezra, tells you about the return under Jeshua and Zerubbabel. So Jeshua was the high priest, Zerubbabel was the governor. You had the king priest and the two of them. Zerubbabel would have been the king if they still had had a kingdom at that time. So the two of them return in Ezra's chapter 1 and 2, Cyrus's decree. They began building the temple in chapter 3. They started working on the foundation of the temple. They worked on it, and they worked on it for about 16 years. And after 16 years of working on the temple, they wore out. They got tired. The adversaries, the Samaritans around them, were causing all kinds of trouble and slowed them down. And so as the work went on, imagine having an ecclesial project that lasted 16 years. And you look back over all the enthusiasm that you started with, over 16 years it would start to drop off. People would have other interests. You'd say, well, I haven't been working on my house for like 14 years. I really think I should do some repairs around my own house for a change. This is what happened in the community. And after 16 years, they got tired. And at that point, the work on the temple stopped. And God made them stop. So what happened at that point is that God raised up a king in the Persian Empire who was an imposter. He really shouldn't have even been the king. And in that little moment of time, he only reigned for 7 months, that king panicked when he got the letter from the Samaritans about these Jews are going to rebel and they're going to take over your kingdom and they're going to leave. And he just said, he sent his Persian army down there and he made them stop. And they weren't allowed to build. And then it was the job of Zerubbabel, or the job of Zechariah and Haggai, to stir the people up and get them working again. And that's what we want to look at this week, is what did Zechariah bring to the table that motivated the people to get back to work? The people were scared. They were in panic. They were afraid to work. Some of them didn't want to work. And yet Zechariah and Haggai together motivated the community to get back involved. And that's the spirit that you want to gain out of the study of Zechariah. What is it in those night visions that stimulated those people to get back to work? And I don't believe it was the future application. If you put yourself in their shoes and you think about why we should get to work in a time period, and somebody tells you, well, in the future this is going to happen. There's going to be another temple built in the future better than this one, so finish this one. That doesn't motivate you to finish this one. What motivated them was the fact that something was in his message about their day and age right now that stimulated these people to become excited about God's work. And that's what we want to walk away with by the end of the week. We want to figure out what was it. So in Ezra 7 to 10, you find Ezra finally comes back. He actually comes back halfway through the book that has his name. He's not even in the first six chapters. And then you find how God used Haman in the story of Esther to convince the Jews to return. Their temple was built. They should come back. And the call came out to get out of Babylon and come down. And the Jews didn't want to come. They didn't want, only 42,000 Jews had returned to the land. And so God used Haman to stir up the people and warn them that you better get out of here while you can, because you're living in a foreign land and somebody like a Haman can come along and wipe you out. And then Nehemiah comes back and he rebuilds the walls. And that's basically the sequence that you find in this time period. Now, yesterday we were looking at, in the exhortation, some of these things about the descendants right there, these kings that reigned at the end. If you've lost track of who those kings were, it's always good to go back and research them. But you're looking at Josiah, good old King Josiah. King Josiah had three sons who reigned and one grandson. So when you go back and look, that what happened is the people of the land put Jehoahaz in charge after Josiah died. Remember, Josiah went to stop Pharaoh Necho when he was on his way up to fight at Carchemish, and Josiah got involved and tried to stop him. If you're ever wondering, like, why did he do that? You know, that's one of the great things people ponder about in the Bible. I really believe that what happened is Josiah and Jeremiah were great friends. And that Josiah, of all the people, believed Jeremiah. He was on track. Josiah was trying to change the people. What did Jeremiah say was going to happen? Don't worry about Egypt. Don't worry about Egypt. Worry about the north. The king of the north is going to come down and invade the land. And so when Pharaoh Necho came up and Josiah went out there and tried to stop him from going up there, remember how Pharaoh Necho even said, get out of the way, go back home, my problem isn't with you. And yet Josiah insisted on fighting him at that point and trying to stop what was inevitable. Because I really think what he saw was that he realized Jeremiah was right, and he was going to try to stop Pharaoh Necho at that point and get in the graces of the king of Babylon at that time so that the Babylonians would not come down. And it's when you start to look at why did he do it, it doesn't fit his character at all. There had to be a good reason Josiah stepped in at that point. And I think he was looking towards the future, trying to stop what he understood from Jeremiah was coming on the people of his land. So then what the people did then is they put Jehoahaz in power, because if you notice, they bypassed Jehoiakim because they all knew he was rotten from the start. And they put his younger brother in charge. But then Pharaoh Necho comes on back down and takes him off to Egypt and leaves Jehoiakim in charge. 11 years they had to put up with his reign. Probably one of the worst kings of Judah. And then when Jehoiakim, he's the one who got taken in the siege when the Babylonians came down. And so his son, Jehoiachin, took over. He only reigned for 3 months. And then he's the one that surrendered and went back up to Babylon at that point. And then the Babylonians put Zedekiah in charge for the last 11 years. But as you're going through that line right there, you find out there's Zerubbabel down there at the bottom. Zerubbabel is said to be the son of Pedaiah in the Chronicles record. And yet every time Zerubbabel is introduced, he's called the son of Shealtiel. So what must have happened is there was probably some Levirate marriage principle involved where he raised up offspring to his brother, and Zerubbabel was probably the actual son of Pedaiah in the Chronicles record, but he's remembered as the son of Shealtiel because that was the Levirate marriage principle, and he raised up offspring to his older brother in this case. That's at least people's best suggestion as to what actually happened. When you go back and look at Jeremiah's prophecies about the 70 years, we know that there was, ahead of time, God had said there'd be 70 years that you're going to be captive. 70 years is going to go by. Jeremiah 25, this was during the early years of Jehoiakim. So this was like one of the first captivities when Daniel went and Jeremiah predicted God was going to bring you back after 70 years. And this is why he then says, well, go ahead and live up there and plant vineyards, build houses, have families, get married, because you're going to be there for 70 years. Then in Jeremiah 29, this would be in the early years of Zedekiah, he was told again that after 70 years, God was going to bring the Jews back and give them a future with a hope of peace. So actually two times he had predicted the 70 years prophecy. That may be why some of the people in the end were a bit mistaken about when the 70 years was really going to be over. That little chart right there is actually very helpful to have in terms of like trying to remember what's actually going on. The kings that were reigning during this period, but when you're talking about Zechariah's night visions, the kings that were actually around at this time was Cyrus. He's the one who makes the decree. I don't like that. He's the one who makes the decree for everybody to go back, and so he gives the Jews permission to return to the land. Then you have Cambyses, his son. And they've started building the temple at this point. Have you ever looked up Cyrus's years that he reigned? He actually reigned for about 18 years. But those 18 years actually started way before he became king of the world at that point, before he took over the Babylonian Empire. He only reigned after he took over and defeated the Babylonians. So they started the temple then right around 6 years before the end of Cyrus's reign. So the last 6 years of his reign, the temple was in works. It started building at that point after he had made his decree, allowed them to return. Then his son Cambyses takes over, and Cambyses reigns for about 8 years. And during that period, they continued the work. But the work on the temple was starting to drag. People were getting discouraged. The Samaritans were causing all this trouble. And then God brings in this guy at the bottom down there we call Gomedes. He's also known in history as fake Smyrtus. They call him pseudo-Smyrtus because he came in as an imposter to the throne. Some people think he actually killed Cambyses and then tried to take over the throne, but he only lasted for 7 months. He's the fellow who actually stopped the work. And God put him in just for a small window of time to stop the work, to challenge the believers on whether or not they were going to get back to building God's house. And finally they did, and Zechariah then comes in the second year of Darius. So Darius is the one who takes over then, Darius Hystaspes, or Darius, whatever you call him, and he takes over then, and then the temple work begins again, and he's the one that looks up and finds the decree that was written in Ecbatana, and then says, oh yes, Cyrus said you could build this, and he allows them to finish the work, and it's all done in 4 years. Because of the work of Zechariah and Haggai working together, they got the people going, and in 4 more years, they finished the whole project. So we want to get a hold of that spirit of what actually happened to get them going. And really, I think you'll see a lot of the same issues apply today. So they built the temple during 6 years of Cyrus's reign at the end. Then Cambyses for 8 years. Gomedes was only in there for 7 months. They finished it in the sixth year of Darius. So the time to build the temple is 20 years. And keep that in mind later on, because that's a number that'll come into play. Now, when you watch what happened in the historical record of what was going on at the time before Zechariah, when they first started building the temple, here's where the problems develop. Ezra chapter 3. So they get all excited, they get back to the land, they build an altar to God, they offer sacrifices, and they start working on laying the foundation. Now you got to remember, this place was a wreck. You know, the Babylonians had burned the city, they'd wrecked the temple, they'd knocked all the stones down, they stole all the gold and the silver and everything they could get, and all this rubble's laying all over the place, and they have to come in and start clearing the stuff out of the way, first of all, and then try to rebuild. So laying the foundation was not an easy job, but they started working on this right in the last 6 years of the reign of Cyrus. But it tells us in Ezra chapter 3 that when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord in verse 10, the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord according to the ordinance of David, king of Israel. They're trying to follow the official rules that David had set up. And they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy forever endures forever towards Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. And it sounds like everybody's excited. But many of the priests and the Levites, ooh, these are the leaders, the priests and the Levites and the heads of the fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first temple, they wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes. Yet many shouted aloud for joy. So you have two classes of people. You have the older group that had seen the former temple, and they see the foundation of this one going up, and they realize, wow, this one's not very good. It's not really built with silver and gold. The stones that we're using aren't near as good as what we had for the last one. This project isn't near as good as the good old days. And then you had the younger people who got involved. They were excited. They were stirred up. They were doing their best working in this project. And they're shouting for joy. And they're all excited about what they're trying to accomplish. And the older ones are over there crying. This is just not as good as what we had before. I think that this was the basis for what happened as the 16 years dragged on and the people wore down. It's a warning of ecclesial life, brethren and sisters, that this is not what we want to bring to our ecclesias. This can very easily happen in our day and age. Sometimes our younger people come up and they've got great ideas. They want to run a project. They organize a witnessing event. And they run the event. And the older ones, they look at the stuff and they say, well, the handout, the leaflet, that's not near as good as what we used to do. And what about how many you're going to hand out? You're only handing out 2,000? We used to do 10,000 barefoot. You know, it's like, and this is what happens in ecclesial life. And if we're not careful, the older ones, we can discourage the young. And you'll find this was one of the great warnings of this time period, is don't discourage the young. Don't despise the day of small things. Ooh, that rang in their ears forever. See, that's what Haggai and Zechariah both reminded the people. Don't despise the day of small things. When we're out there doing the best we can with the resources that we have, God is excited. He's not discouraged. He doesn't look at our leaflet and say, what's the problem? It's not as good as the old days. He just looks to see, are we doing the best we can with what we have? And he gets excited, and so do the angels. And you're going to see in Zechariah more about angels than you'll see in any other Bible book. And it reveals to us how excited they were. They're there saying, like we sang in that hymn last night, how long, O Lord our Savior, till you remain away? You know, those angels in Zechariah wondered, how long are you going to wait, God, before you again turn to Jerusalem and rebuild her and restore it? These were angels saying this to God. They couldn't wait for the project to go on. They weren't despising the day of small things. Oh, no. Zechariah sees a vision, and these angels, they rejoice to see the plumb line and the hand of Zerubbabel, and they're back to work again. See, the angels are more excited about ecclesial projects than we are, because this is how they develop people for God's family. They don't care about how good the leaflet is. They don't care about how many thousands we handed out. They can make sure they get to the right people. What they want to know is, do we have that enthusiastic spirit? Are we working in God's word? Are we doing what we can for the ecclesia with the best that we have? Are we giving it our full effort? And if we are, they are thrilled. And we don't have to look back at the old days and think, well, maybe our project wasn't as good. This was the problem that developed. This is one of the things that slowed down the work. So they couldn't discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people, and the sound was heard afar off. Oh yeah, afar off. The Samaritans heard the Jews rejoicing. And then here come the Samaritans in Ezra chapter 3. And they want to join in the work, right? And they want to get involved. That's what happened, and they had to draw a line. So the younger people in this case were shouting, praising. They were excited about the project. But no, the older ones, nah, they despised it. They looked at it and they said, that's not any good. It's not like we used to do. It's not like those good old days. Somebody once suggested, I think it was Ron Cowie, when he was giving his classes, he said that really what happens with the older folks is that the only reason is they were good old days is because they have selective memories and can't really remember what happened. And that's why they remember the good old days. It's probably just more of a misconception than it really is. But look at how both prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, both have to deal with this issue. When Haggai says in chapter 2 at verse 3, and God says, look at your temple. Look at what you have going so far. And he says, is it not as in your sight as nothing? You don't consider this worth it. But God does. The angels do. And Zechariah comes in chapter 4. Who's despised the day of small things? Not the angels. They rejoice to see it all going up, and they're thrilled about what's happening in this time. When you go back and look at the kings in Ezra, if you ever want to do a study of Ezra chapter 4 and try to figure those out, the actual names of the kings in Ezra 4 aren't really the same as what we call them in history. Cyrus, of course, is the one who made the decree. And then you have Ahasuerus comes in our Bible in Ezra chapter 4, who is probably then his son, Cambyses. And then you have a fellow called Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes is actually the one who stops the work in Ezra chapter 4. This is the imposter fellow called Pseudo-Smyrnus, or some people call him Gomates. And he only lasted for 7 months. And then we have Darius Hystaspes, who comes in, and the work is finished in his day. So those are basically the four kings that are involved in this whole period of finishing the temple. And that's basically how they're laid out in getting the temple work done. So what happened? Why did God stop the work in Ezra chapter 3? But what happens is the Samaritans in chapter 4 there, they write their letters, they write to the king in chapter 4, and they say, look at these Jews, if you allow them to finish, they're going to rebel. The walls are going up. They don't say temple walls, they just say the walls, and they make it sound like it was the city walls and trying to defend themselves, and they're going to rebel against the king. Well, what happened is that 15 years of working, 16 years, whatever it was, had worn the people out and got them discouraged. The project had gone on too long. The older people didn't even like the new temple, and they would go around in their own way and they despise it. They'd look at it and it was like, ugh, they weren't excited about it. And that discouraged the younger people. It did. And the adversaries, it says in Ezra, they hired counselors against them. They were trying to stop the work. And in the end, after that much time goes by, brothers and sisters, I think all of us would want to go spend more time on our own homes, our own projects, plant our own gardens, get our own things done, paint our walls at home, you know, redo our tiled floors, put in new carpeting. We would want to do those kind of things. And what happened is, as the time went on and it dragged on, more and more people left the project and went back to doing their own things. And eventually, the number of workers were very thin. Hardly anybody was left. And so God made them stop. He just made them stop by sending in the Persian army. And the people were afraid of the adversaries at this point because they were scared. The adversaries come in, they say, all right, did you say you could build? What's your name right there? I'm going to write it down. What's your name? They wrote him down. We're going to go to the king and tell him, you and you and you, Dan and Jason, you know, we're going to say, give him a name. They wrote down the names, and they really intimidated the people. And they tried to spook them out. And so Zechariah and Haggai had to really get involved at this point and try to encourage the people to get working on this building again. So when you go back and look at what Haggai brings to the table, Haggai tells you what the people were doing. First of all, in Haggai's prophecy, he says, first thing that people did is they said, it's not the right time. We shouldn't be building the temple right now. The 70 years aren't over. So that would be like today saying, well, Christ can't come back today. He can't come back tomorrow. There's such and such a prophecy has to happen. This has to happen. This has to happen. So, yeah, Christ can't come back for five more years. But that's not true. God can rearrange things. We have to be ready because the Son of Man is coming at an hour we don't expect. We have to be ready. That's what Jesus left on record in Matthew 24 and 25. When you look at those three parables in 25, it's all about be ready. Be like those wise virgins we sang about last night. They were ready. They had oil in their lamps and were ready to go. They slumbered and slept, but they were ready. They were ready. And that's the goal, is we have to be ready because he's coming at an hour we don't expect. So one of the first problems was that they claimed the time wasn't right. And if you're wondering, like, how that ever happened, how could they claim in prophecy the time wasn't right? It was all a matter of where you start the 70 years. Where do we start the 70 years? So do we start the 70 years way back when Daniel was taken captive, back in the third, fourth year of Jehoiakim? Or do we start the 70 years when the temple was finally destroyed? And so what happened is the people that were building at this point after 15, 16 years, when they were looking to justify what they really wanted to do, they simply came and told the community, quit building. You shouldn't be doing it right now. The time isn't right. We still got a few more years. We shouldn't start building until the green 70 years are all over, and that's when we'll start building. Wherein God really intended is he wanted the temple finished at the end of that 70-year period. Now remember I told you to watch that 20 years that it took to build the temple, the 20-year period? That 20-year period in there at the end of the arrows is actually the difference at the beginning of the arrows. It was 20 years from the one beginning of the 70 years to the beginning of the other one. There was a 20-year period in there between when Daniel was taken captive and when finally Zedekiah was gone and the temple was destroyed. And it turned out that that was the key to this problem in the end about what about the time is not right. So what the people did then, Haggai says, is they said, all right, if the time's not right, let's go home. We'll work on our houses. We got lots to do. We'll get a new car. We'll polish it all up. We'll take care of the carpeting that's so dirty, and we'll redo the floors. And we need some granite maybe on our kitchen sinks right there. And, the bedrooms need to be remodeled. And people got into their own projects instead of working on God's. And that's a warning to ourselves that this is what happens in ecclesial life. I really fear in ecclesial life, brethren and sisters, especially the arranging brethren that are here, or those of you that make ecclesial decisions. We sometimes get so excited about our ecclesial decisions about this thing, this issue versus this issue, and we make a decision that, based on a black and white case about an issue, and we don't look down the long run about what this is going to do to our young people over there. How is this issue going to affect them? And sometimes we make decisions in ecclesial life that are so discouraging to the young people. They look at our decisions that we've made and they wonder, how could you ever do that? How could you cut somebody off? How could you not be interested in working towards a solution to this problem? How can you just so easily make a decision? And the young people look at that and they wonder, what are we doing? And they get very discouraged. And it's easy to do that to our young people. And we have to, as leaders, as shepherds of the community, we have to make good decisions, but don't forget about the decisions for the future of the kids, that we want to make decisions that allow our kids to be involved in our community and have lots of friends in our community and to have good CYCs and to have a good positive environment. They don't want to hear about all the negative. They want to hear about the positives of our community, and it would be good to stress those things to our kids. So that's what Haggai comes in. Haggai brings to the temple. He comes in probably as an older man, exhorting the people about, look at what choices that you've made over the last few years. And that's what Haggai did. Remember, I kept saying, consider your ways, or what some of the modern versions say is, consider how you have fared. Look back at your life over the last 20 years and look at what's happened, especially since you quit working on the temple. How are things going? Have you really got that economic prosperity you thought you were going to get? Did you really have the money to redo the kitchen and to fix up all that stuff? Or has inflation just been eating it up? And didn't you realize God sent famines? God raised inflation and he did all that stuff. You had pockets with holes in them. And you made all that money on your crops, put it in your pockets, and it fell right through. Didn't you watch the signs of your life and realize God wasn't really prospering this decision? And see, that's interesting because we have to do the same thing. We don't have prophets coming around telling us about latter-day events. We have to read the signs, like I was saying last night with Jeremiah and Jeremiah's family and what that did to him and made him rethink issues when they wanted to kill him. God talks to us through economic conditions. He talks to us through health issues. He talks to us through ecclesial problems, through family issues. We have to read the signs. And these people weren't reading the signs. So what God did then is he raised up a king in the Persian Empire. He raises up, he has Cambyses killed and pulled off the scene, and he brings in a king who for 7 months stopped the work, and then he decides, all right, it's time to give them an opportunity again. And he brings Darius Hystaspes to the throne, and Darius Hystaspes he's got power, he's got authority, and he can allow the work to continue. So he does this by bringing Darius to the throne, and some of the Jews realized it. They read the signs, they realized a new king was in power, and they said to the community, what do you think? Maybe we should get back to work. And they did. They started working on the temple. They were scared. They were afraid. But they got back to work, and then Haggai and Zechariah come in and say, keep going. You know, the angels are behind you. God's behind the project, and he promises he'll get it done. And that's what Haggai and Zechariah bring to the table. That's why in Ezra chapter 5, you'll see that that's actually the reference back there. It's the coordinated efforts of these two prophets that actually got the work going and got it done at this point. The prophets of God, Ezra says, were helping them in Ezra 5 at verse 2. Haggai was probably an older man, and what he does is he exhorts the people as an older man about, look at your life, look at the decisions you've been making, and has God really blessed them? Think about it. And then Zechariah comes in, probably the younger guy, who's the grandson of Iddo at this point. And what he does is he brings a whole new level to this thing. And he says, look at behind the scenes what the angels are doing for you. And you don't even realize it. They're out there working for you 24/7, 365. They care more about your future here than you do. And they're out there working constantly. You just can't see them. And he tries to raise their level of awareness in 7 night visions about how God is there to help them in their time of need. And he does that through the work of the angels. And they promise that they will finish this work, and it shows you how excited they are about getting this project done. So when you look at how the two of them work together, Haggai and Zechariah, this is in the second year of Darius. So now Darius has come to the throne. It took Darius probably about a year to get the Persian Empire back under control. When you go back and look in history, it seems that what happened was when Gomedes took over, that there were a bunch of outskirt nations that were rebelling from the empire. This is what the Samaritans used as their excuse for the Jews, is that they were going to rebel. Well, some of the nations that are on the outskirts of the Persian Empire did rebel, and so when Darius Hystaspes takes over, it took him a good year or so to bring the Persian Empire back under control. That was the work of the angels. Did you realize that's what Zechariah 1 was really all about? Was that the angels had been out there patrolling the earth and brought the whole earth under rest? And now they said to the other angels, to say, we've done our job. And the angel under the myrtle tree looks up God and says, how long are you going to wait? We're ready. We brought the earth back under control. We're ready to go. Let's get this project done. And that's the excitement that's there in Zechariah chapter 1. That's actually what the first vision is really all about. So Haggai comes in this second year, and he comes in and he says, look, consider how you fared in the 6th month on the first day. Go back and look over the last few years. Have you really gotten out of life what you thought you were going to get? Or did God really just blow it away? Because that's what he says. You know, you thought you made all this stuff, you made all these choices, you're going to economically prosper, build bigger barns, and God says, I blew it all away. So you would get the point that that was not what you should have been doing. Haggai chapter 1 verse 12, 6th month, 24th day, so you're 23 days later. They finally began working on the temple again. He gets them back to work. Haggai chapter 2, the 7th month now, so you're about a month later, 21st day. It's the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, and God comes in and reminds them, I am with you. Keep going on this project. We are going to get it done. And Zechariah then comes in the 8th month of this same year, and he says, look it, Zechariah reminds them, you've got to get back to work, all of you, or you could end up facing captivity again. If you go back to your own things, and you go back and get involved in your own lives, and you turn again to this world and get involved in idolatry, that's why we went captive in the first place. And Haggai comes back in chapter 2 at verse 10 in the ninth month and the 24th day. Then he says, look at the nation's unclean. You're unclean. Everything you touch is unclean. And uncleanness is just transferring. But I will bless you if you trust me. I'll change you. And we're going to get this done. But you've got to trust God working in your life. And then Zechariah comes in the 11th month, 2 months later, on the 24th day, and you see the night visions, the seven night visions that God promises. The temple will be built, and he promises it will be finished during the days of Joshua and Zerubbabel. So we're not looking at some long-term project that's going to go on beyond their time. He said, I promise it will get done, and Joshua will be the high priest, and Zerubbabel, the man whose name is the branch, you will be alive at the time, and you will be there as governor when the temple is finished. And then Zechariah 7, I hope to look at the end of the week. Hopefully we'll look at, this is in the fourth year of Darius, so you're only 2 years before the temple's finished at this point, and you get the delegation that comes in from Bethel at that point. It's fun to look at what was happening in the community, and they're getting so close to having the temple finished at this point. So we might get to that hopefully at the end of the week. So in Zechariah chapter 1 for today, when you go back and look at what was actually happening in Zechariah, Zechariah 1, the first six verses are really about an exhortation to return to the Lord or you're going to face captivity again. You have to learn from past experiences. We went through all of this, the 70-year captivity, so that you would put away idolatry and trust God. You don't want to go back to this again. Do you know they actually were pretty successful at that? When you go back and look at God's plan, there were two things that bothered the nation of Israel and Judah over the whole period of the kingdom, from the time of David on down, really, to the time of Saul, even back into the period of the Judges. You ever notice reading through the Judges, you go through Joshua and Judges, and you see the conflict between the tribes. They never got along. There was always conflict. You know, Jephthah goes out and wins a great battle, and the Ephraim might say to him, hey, what's the problem? You didn't invite us. Who do you think you are? And that's the response he got from his community after destroying those people on the other side of the Jordan. It's like, man, who do you think you are going out and doing that and making us look bad? And that's what was happening in the community. They were always fighting and bickering, and there was just no unity amongst the tribes. You go through the period of Joshua, it's like that. Remember when the 2.5 tribes went back after they were fighting together for 7 years and conquering the land of Canaan? The 2.5 tribes go back, and they build an altar on the western side of the Jordan. So they build an altar over there, and rumor comes down to the south, and they hear, oh, do you hear what they did? They built an altar up there. You hear that? Yeah, they're going to offer sacrifices up there. They're going to rebel, and we're all going to be destroyed again. So they said, everybody, grab their sword, let's go kill them. That was the response of people who had been fighting together for 7 years, taking over the land. This is what we're like, brothers and sisters. This is by nature what we are. Conflict arises in an ecclesia, in a family, and we want to gird on our swords and slice each other up. It's sad, but you can just read it in the Bible over and over again. This is what we have to fight. That is the natural tendency of many of our leaders, many of our community. So at that point, Phinehas says, wait a minute, let's go talk to them first and find out why they did it. Don't you think you should find that out before you kill them? And they go up there, and the delegation goes up, and they ask, why'd you build that altar? Oh, we didn't trust you guys. We thought maybe in the future, our kids would not be allowed to come in the land and cross the Jordan and worship with you. We thought maybe you wouldn't let our kids worship anymore. So we built that altar as a memorial. We don't intend to offer sacrifices. We want to make sure you never refuse access to our children, to the land, so they can go down to Jerusalem and they can offer sacrifices in the land. And Phinehas hears that and is like, wow, we never thought of that. That's a great idea. But they had to ask. They had to communicate. They had to find out why before they grabbed their swords and cut each other up. But those stories are there to remind us and as examples that this is our natural tendency. This is how people want to respond, and we have to be careful. So that's, you look back at what God was trying to do with these people in Zechariah 1, that's Zechariah's first warning, is don't go back to the captivity. Because what it did is it solved the problem of disunity. Do you realize that when they finally came back under Ezra, they finally came back to the land, they were united as one man. It says that in Ezra, and it says it in Nehemiah. It was the first time unity had actually come to the community because they were so small and they realized they needed each other. So he knocked the disunity out of the community by sending them off to captivity, and he also knocked idolatry out of them. He actually got the idols out of their hearts. That he said back in Ezekiel that these people had their idols in their hearts. He kicked them out of their hearts by taking them up captive. And they didn't go back to idolatry again. Yeah, right up to the time of Christ, you can see that. When Jesus went out to preach to the people, the problem wasn't idolatry. Oh, no. The problem now became legalism. They turned it into a different problem. And that's what he had to face with the Judaizers of his time. So the vision in chapter 1 then, you get this message in chapter 1 then, in the first vision about the four horsemen, and that's in verses 7 to 11, and then you get in 12 to 17 that God is going to extend mercy to Jerusalem and he will build his house again. He promises them he'll get it done. And then there is the vision of the four horns and the four craftsmen. So at the beginning of Zechariah 1, you get the message. There it is. Return to me. You've got to come back and be faithful. Let's make commitment here. You can't be working on your own projects to the exclusion of God's house. You've got to make time for God. And so return to me or face captivity again. And that was the message that had been earlier in Jeremiah 3 before the captivity had ever begun that we were looking at last night. That actually gets quoted later on in Malachi when Malachi, right at the end of the Old Testament, is reminding the people that this is what God had wanted. Our God is faithful and he won't fail us if we return to him. Turn from your evil ways, he says in chapter 1. It's actually taken right out of 2 Kings 17 when he explained why he had to remove Israel from the land, the northern kingdom. And his warning to the people was, if you don't respond, don't think I won't do it again. I will. I'll remove you from the land again. And he did later on, and when the Romans came in, he did it again because he wanted change in the people. He was looking for a response. So the people do. They respond in Zechariah 1. They say, you're right, God. Everything you say is right. We made the mistake. You've been right all along. And that's the first step to making change in our lives, is acknowledging God is right. We were wrong, and we really do want to change. And these people responded now the right way, and they now started looking for help in their life. So the first vision that comes in then in Zechariah chapter 1, watch what happens in this first vision. Zechariah looks, and he sees a man riding in on a red horse, and he's riding on a red horse. He's standing amongst the myrtle trees. So this man on the red horse, he's the fellow who's under the myrtle trees right there. And then there are red and sorrel and white horses that come in as well. And what were they doing? Well, the three that come in, they say to the man who's under the myrtle trees, they say, we've been patrolling the earth, and now all the earth is at rest. Now, you see what they've done? These were the angels that had been sent out when Darius Hystaspes took over the kingdom, and they said, look, you've got to bring the Persian Empire back under control so that the Persian king will be at rest. He'll understand there's no risk of these Jews rebelling, and he'll grant them the opportunity to finish this temple. And they did all of that, and it's in the whole empire. They're out there working so that this house can get built. This is like when Paul would say, all things are for your sakes. The angels have been doing all of this in the whole empire just so that God's house could be finished. And they come back and they tell the angel that. They say, look, this is what we've done. When you look at the colored horses, I think it's fun when you're going through Zechariah this week, just watch how many references there are and allusions to things that come up in the Revelation. There's no sense studying Revelation without having looked at Zechariah and also looking at Daniel. Those are the two key books that form the basis for understanding the characters that show up in the Revelation. Here we have the four horses right there. And you're going to see them again later on in Zechariah chapter 6. Those are not new when they show up in Revelation. They had been there before. And they were the angels out there patrolling the earth. And things that they had done to influence the political climate of the times. This is what that was used for. So it's not that they're necessarily the exact same thing, but they're similar things when they're picked up in Revelation. And this is the angels that have the power to enforce war and famine and pestilence and peace throughout the earth. The myrtle trees. This one angel, he's standing under the myrtle trees. You wonder, like, what's that for? Well, the myrtle tree was one of the evergreens in that period. And it was used to represent endurance and stability and peace because it was always green and it was one of the survivors, even in periods of drought. You look back, it may actually be connected to Esther as well, because at this time period, you're only a few years away from when the temple finally is finished in the sixth year. So we're only 4 years away from the period when Esther becomes queen. And so it's an interesting reference to the myrtle trees right now. That here's this angel standing there under the myrtle trees. And Esther comes along, whose name is Hadassah, which is the myrtle. And these angels, these same angels, were going to be involved in orchestrating the events that brought Esther to the throne, so that when Nehemiah comes along to build the walls, all the political climate is there. The queen's sitting there on the throne. And the king says, sure, Nehemiah, go back and build the walls. This is what angels do. They're out there all the time. They're carrying out God's game plan, and they're doing it behind the scenes. None of the people of Zechariah's day, none of them saw an angel that we know of. Just like today. There were no angels walking around that people realized. No angel just showed up and said, here's what's happening. They had to read the signs, be aware of God's work in their life, and they had to see how it was happening behind the scenes. And that's the fun thing to watch as you go through all these events. So there's what the myrtle actually looked like, if you're wondering what, and it actually really wasn't a tree, it was like a big bush. But as the bush grew up, it could actually become big enough that you could actually get underneath the shade of the myrtle tree, and it appears that's what the angel did. So who are the horsemen? Well, these horsemen are the ones that the Lord had sent to patrol the earth. They've been walking to and fro in verse 10 throughout the whole earth. You find in chapter 4, in verse 10, that these seven, the seven eyes that were on the stone, are the eyes of the Lord, which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. And there's these constant references in the book of Zechariah to the angels and how involved the angels were in carrying out God's plan, but nobody saw them. See, it's just like today. The angels are involved in your life. They're ordering events of your life. They're bringing things into your life to face and situations, good and bad, in order to help us develop into God's children. This is what they do in our families, in our ecclesia, in our worldwide community, and they're also involved in the political events, just as they are like here. It's very similar to what we were told back in 2 Chronicles 16, that they're the eyes of the Lord that run to and fro throughout the whole earth, and they show themselves strong on behalf of those who fear God. That was the story, that was the lesson that King Asa had not learned when he went and carried it out his own way. So when you look at, well, what had they done? The angels at this point, they'd suppressed the adversaries of Ezra 4, the ones that were like trying to like stop the work. They were hiring counselors against them. They were writing letters to the king. They stopped it at this point, and they wouldn't allow them to do it right now, and they got the people working again. They put down all the rebellions that were going on throughout the empire ever since Gomedi had taken over for that, should be 7 months right there, his 7 month takeover, and the problems that it caused. And now they brought the earth back to rest, and the earth is resting quietly. That's what they were doing. If you go back in Ezra chapter 5, it's really fun to watch in that one chapter of all the events that the angels had been doing to bring this to pass. You find out that remember when the decree was finally found, when the challenge was made and they wrote the letter to the king, this is King Darius now, and King Darius has to search the records and he has to find out, did Cyrus really ever make this decree? And they find this record up in Ecbatana in the summer residence of the kings, and he reads it and he finds out, oh yeah, he did make a decree. Do you ever notice in Ezra chapter 1 when Cyrus made the decree, did you notice how it said that he made the decree and put it in writing? Do you ever notice that, underline that, and make a reference to the fact it had to be in writing so that they could find it 20 years later and give them the permission again to finish the work? Otherwise, Darius probably wouldn't have done that. He wouldn't have given them that permission. But he does. He finds the decree up at Ecbatana, and he says, go ahead and look at what he writes back to the adversaries that tried to intimidate the Jews. You know, what's your name? What's your name? And he writes back and he says, from now on, you guys, keep yourselves far from there, in verse 6. Don't go anywhere near these Jews. You're not even allowed anywhere near what they're doing. Let the work of this house of God alone. And this is fascinating about what angels can do in your life when you trust them. Look at what they did here. Let the cost be paid from the king's expense from taxes. So the very Samaritans that caused all this trouble trying to stop the work, in the end, King Darius sends down to them and says, you guys leave them alone, let the Jews finish. And you know what? All those taxes you're paying, you guys are going to, that tax money, they're going to use that money to finish the house. So that whatever the Jews need, they can take it out of the tax money we collect in that area and get this house built. This is what angels do for us when we trust them and we put things into their hands. In verse 9, and whatever else they need, let it be given to them day by day without fail. I think that it's fascinating to watch how the angels were totally in control at this time. And so they come back to God and they say, God, in Zechariah chapter 1, you know, how long will you not have mercy? You look at this in Zechariah 1. These are angels talking to another angel who's the myrtle, the one under the myrtle tree. He in turn looks up at God. You get to see the interaction of the angels right here and the hierarchy that's there amongst the angels. And it gives us an insight to what the kingdom age will be like. And then this angel says, look it, we did our job. You asked us to bring the earth back under control. How long are you going to wait? They don't know everything. They don't know the whole plan. Angels don't know that, and neither will we in the kingdom age. You get told enough to carry out your job, but God's the only one, or Jesus Christ will, and they know the whole game plan from end to finish. And we simply get told the part that we're supposed to do. And they remind him, look, God, you're angry at the nations. You know, you should be showing mercy to Jerusalem. And they get told, all right, God's house will be built. He promises he's going to finish this house, and he will again choose Jerusalem. And so God then comes back with these assurances to the angels, who then in turn are excited about getting the house built. And Zechariah would come back and tell the people, this is what this first vision was all about. Can you imagine the next morning when Zechariah wakes up and he comes back and tells the people, I saw this vision. You know, I saw the angels that went out and patrolled the earth, and they brought all the earth at rest. That's why Darius Hystaspes is in the throne right now, so that we can finish the temple. And one angel came back and said to another one, you know, they've done their job. And the other angel asked God, how long are you going to wait? These angels are excited about getting this project done. They're on our side. We won't fail. We can get this done. And that's the way it is today, brothers and sisters. The angels are there. They're on our side. And we've got to trust them in the work in our families and our ecclesias. When you look at the long-term fulfillment, and you look at, well, could this apply again at the end of time? And certainly when Christ comes back, I think you can see how this would apply again. The angels are out there totally involved in the political scenarios going on in our world. They're going to bring all the events to the right point so that Jesus Christ can return, and the king of the north and the king of the south are going to, you know, be against each other, and the northern army will come down on Israel. It will all be the result of these angels, and they're going to bring about these events for Christ to return. The fun thing to watch here is how excited they are. They want to get this done. They want God's kingdom to come. They're excited about it today, and we got to join in their excitement. And they're excited for God to have mercy on Jerusalem, to send back the king priest so that he can finally rebuild God's house in the kingdom age and sit on the throne of David and operate as priest. And the Jews, they've got to return to God or be destroyed. Two-thirds in the land are going to be cut off, and only one-third are going to be refined. That's part of this whole kingdom process. But these angels are excited, brethren and sisters, and I hope that we get as excited as them. Sometimes in ecclesial life, we get discouraged, we get run down, the years drag on, and we sort of like lapse in our excitement. Zechariah's prophecies will bring that excitement back into your life when you realize how excited the immortal angels are to work in your life, to work towards this end of having us ready for God's kingdom, and they can't wait until God's house is assembled. Not the physical house. They're looking for the spiritual house. When we are joined to God's family and we have the opportunity to join the angels and live in the presence of God forever. And hopefully Zechariah will bring that excitement to us too. Thanks.